All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Michael P. Allen is presiding. All who have business before this court, draw near and you will be heard. God bless the United States and its Honorable Court. Please be seated.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Judge Allen, and I'm joined by Judge Greenberg, who's appearing remotely this morning, and Judge Toth, who's with me here in the courtroom. We're convened this morning to consider arguments in the matter of Terry L. Hamilton versus Dennis McDonough, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, case number 22-3726. Would counsel, beginning with appellant's counsel, enter your...
April Donahauer for Mr. Hamilton from Chisholm, Chisholm, and Kilpatrick, and
morning to both of you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Mark Hamill and Drew Silo for the Secretary.
Thanks. Nice to see you both again. Ms. Donahauer, I understand you want to reserve some time for rebuttal. So we'll make that happen. If counsel are ready, you can begin.
May it please the court. The work product doctrine has no business determining whether evidence from the file VA used to settle Mr. Hamilton's FTCA administrative claim is part of the record here. The work product doctrine prevents adversaries in litigation from piggybacking on each other's preparation efforts. But there were no adversaries here. VA settled Mr. Hamilton's FTCA claim pursuant to a non-adversarial administrative process. And in the pro-claimant system for adjudicating his 1151 claims, VA had not only a significant informational advantage over him, but also statutory duties to use that advantage to his benefit. What evidence Mr. Hamilton could discover in some never-to-occur adversarial litigation is immaterial here.
Did Mr. Hamilton request the documents under FOIA? Did he do the discovery request?
He did not, Your Honor. He notified VA that he had settled the tort claim and raised its relevance before the board.
So could I ask you... let's just step back for a second, leave the benefit system aside, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So the FTCA process
is,
so there is this period of time in which the agency is given the federal agency is given the opportunity to consider the claim. That's that six-month period where you have to, they get 6 months to do this, and then if no action is taken or if not compromised, then you can file a litigation, right?
Correct.
Okay. Is your position that the materials that are generated, I'm going to call it the administrative file, right, in that six-month period, that would be protected by the work product doctrine generically in if there were then litigation? Is that right?
It's a difficult question to answer, Your Honor. I would say ultimately, if the agency decides at a point that they're going to litigation, then subsequently in adversarial litigation, that protection might exist. But in a case, whereas here we know that they settled, at least up until that decision point, what they're doing is for the veterans' benefit.
So I'm with you. I'm taking this in very little baby steps, right, because I, too, we have not been able to find, meaning me and my law clerk, have not been able to find any court out there that actually definitively answers this question, which is in that six-month period, is that designed for resolution so these adversarial concepts don't apply, or is it really a precursor to litigation, even though it may never come to be, right? Because the work product doctrine itself is in anticipation of litigation. It doesn't require that there actually be litigation. It's only in anticipation of. Right. So is your position should approach this case and hold that that those administrative files are simply not subject to work product doctrine, or is there a narrower way that we can reach the result you'd like us to reach?
There's certainly a narrower way here because we know that the claim settled. So I don't think we can say there was there wasn't a subjective belief that litigation was a reasonable probability. I think that would be the test. And when VA is heading towards settling the claim, there's not an objectively reasonable subjective belief that litigation is going to ensue.
Are you familiar with a regulation which neither party cited, I think, which is 38 CFR 1.511?
Yes. That is the regulation that there's a provision in that regulation about the disclosure of records when an FTCA claim has been filed.
Yes, it's it's about disclosure of claimant records in conjunction with judicial proceedings generally. That's what it says. And subdivision A2 seems to say exactly what you've said, right, that you can't release these documents, et cetera, other than as would normally be done in the context of civil litigation. So is it your view of the regulation that what that does is only come into play by creating this protection once something is filed as opposed to beforehand?
I have reservations about the validity of this regulation as the work product doctrine is understood for the reasons we just discussed a moment ago, in that when the claim has simply been filed and VA is engaging in an objective process for evaluating that claim and determining whether there's some non-litigation resolution for the claim, I don't think this rule's attempt to incorporate the work product doctrine into disclosure of those records is correct against the case law.
So have you been able to find any cases under the FTCA, it doesn't have to be in the VA context, or frankly any system in which before you bring a suit against the government there is this period of time for negotiated resolution that one way or the other addresses this question about whether, again, leaving aside the fact that we're in the non-adversarial benefits process, but any case that actually squarely addresses whether the work product doctrine protects those records?
The only case we were able to find is the one cited in the reply brief, the Fifth Circuit with no reasoning, an unreported case with no reasoning as to why. And not only is there no reasoning to support that, I'd call it an assumption, not a holding, but I think it's contrary to at least the reasoning of the reported cases on the matter. The case of Martin versus Office of Special Counsel, which I think is a D.C. Circuit case, walks through the MSPB proceedings and talks about how materials prepared for those are in reasonable anticipation of litigation and is careful to draw the line between situations where the rules of evidence apply explicitly through the agency regulations where there's a hearing. None of those exist here. It was an informal process designed to try to avoid litigation for both parties' sake.
But so that's sort of we're making this call sort of ex post, right?
Mm-hmm.
Meaning we know that there was a claim that was filed and then it was resolved without the need to go to litigation under the FTCA. But why wouldn't we, as a court, in terms of the work product protection, look at this ex ante? In other words, if you're an agency lawyer and you've got the claim that's been filed, you might be able to resolve this without going to court, right? Or you might not. But determining whether your material that you're generating, or as the Supreme Court said in Hickman, literally the product of your work, is something you can keep, it seems to me if you don't have a rule at the start, then it doesn't do much good to only get the rule at the back end. You see what I mean?
Yes, and I won't give you a reason not to look at it ex ante, and I think if you do look at it ex ante, it's not in reasonable anticipation of litigation. It's an objective assessment of the merits of the claim, and if that objective assessment shows the claim to be meritorious, then it should be resolved without litigation to conserve both parties' resources and the court's resources. I just meant to say that if the court doesn't want to hold that broadly, then certainly here we have a case where the claim was settled.
So I want to ask kind of two different questions. So the first is kind of what we do if the work product doctrine applies, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm imagining a file with some things in the file would be like attorney notes, thoughts, so normally subject, you know, covered by the work product doctrine. Others might just be records that themselves would, under Rule 26, just be discoverable, right? So somebody has to parse out those documents and figure out which, you know, would be disclosed and which wouldn't. Who would do that?
First of all, this court would need to set some guardrails as a matter of law. I agree with Your Honor's premise that there may be some sorting through to do, but this court should at the outset say what is and isn't, as a matter of law, protected.
Sure. Are you talking about subject matter or the identity of the person who would?
Well, just to, we can walk through the examples of items that the Secretary said in his brief are potentially at issue here. So medical records, as Your Honor stated, obviously not attorney work product. Information related to Mr. Hamilton's economic losses, also obviously not attorney work product. Indeed, because the claimant is required to submit that information, VA doesn't develop it. Information about whether healthcare providers were VA employees, it's just a fact, it's not attorney work product. Statements obtained from VA from healthcare providers and other witnesses, that gets a little murkier, but certainly there's no authority for saying that Mr. Hamilton wouldn't even have access to the identities of those witnesses. And I think it bears mentioning here that the work product doctrine just says what's eligible for protection. It doesn't say what requires non-disclosure. So, and it can be overcome in situations where there's undue burden and substantial hardship on the party trying to get the information. And a veteran's case, if there ever was one, is the hallmark of a situation where the protection should give way to those interests.
So, I mean, normally that would be like a district court judge doing in camera.
Yes.
Is the board member just get the file and parse it out? Or Judge Allen cited a regulation, you know, which has a person called a regional counsel,
mm-hmm.
who appears to be under FOIA. Like, their job is to look at matters and then figure out what's covered under Privacy Act and HIPAA and stuff like that. So somebody appears to do a kind of threshold screening. Could they not also do, you know, screening for anything that looks like attorney work product?
They should not, Your Honor. That process needs to happen within the VA claims adjudication system by an adjudicator who would issue an appealable decision subject to judicial review. It can't happen in the Office of Regional Counsel where presumably Mr. Hamilton would have no recourse.
Right. I mean, but the tough thing is, I mean, there's going to be, I mean, in camera is obviously secret, right? It's not. So, I mean, somebody would have to do, we can't just sort of disclose it and then figure out. It's not like a Fourth Amendment suppression or something where everybody knows it's there. We just don't mention it. I mean, it somebody has to do some type of screening. And again, this is, you know, the hypothetical is assuming the work product doctrine applies. Somebody has to do some type of screening.
Mm-hmm.
Unless it just covers everything.
Mm-hmm. So there are two paths here, potentially. One is something akin to a privilege log. So VA would have to prepare something. And this gets at one of the...
Could I just ask you, though, because I'm having the same trouble thinking about how the way this works in practice mm-hmm. can be implemented in the context of the benefit system, because who would make the privilege log? Right, I agree with you. That's the way it starts out in litigation, which is if I have something that I'm not producing, I have to give the other party an opportunity to be able to challenge that by, you know, crafting the privilege log in whatever way the local court says it needs to be done. Then that the other party can then challenge designations, at which point the judge is usually then going to look at things in camera if they're not going to do it as like a matter of law on a category of documents or something. How does that process, in your view, how can that be implemented in the non-adversarial system where VA isn't represented by a lawyer?
I don't think the concern is whether VA is represented by a lawyer. I think that the concern is ensuring that Mr. Hamilton gets disclosure of everything that could be relevant.
I'm with you. Let's just assume that the way I were thinking, and I'm not saying this is the way I'm thinking, is to say the work product doctrine applies to govern, to protect this file, meaning it can protect the file.
I accept the hypothetical.
Okay. And then we say, all right, you win, Mr. Hamilton. You win under that scenario because the board did nothing to determine what could or could not actually be disclosable that's in this file, because it's not the file that's protected, it's the parts, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now then we send it back to the board. And while we might let the board try to figure this out on its own, it might be helpful to give them some sort of thought. So this isn't like, oh, Mr. Hamilton, you lose because VA doesn't have a lawyer. The point is, how physically would you anticipate this working, right? If somebody's going to create a privilege log, who's creating the privilege log? Because it seems odd to say it's the board that's creating the privilege log, because the board then is the one that's going to then adjudicate whether or not what's put on the privilege log is sufficient.
No, and I didn't mean to suggest that the board creates the privilege log. I think potentially, and I'll just preface this by saying that opposing counsel probably has better insight into the machinations of VA and how this process could go forward. But to Your Honor's question, I think the part of the agency having custody over the FTCA file would be the most sensible preparer of the privilege log that could then go to the board for evaluation.
And that's what I thought Judge Tote's question had suggested, and you pushed back and said that couldn't happen, right? In other words, the part having custody of the file, it seems to me, would be the regional council, right?
I was saying to Judge Tote's question that regional council doesn't get to decide what goes into Mr. Hamilton's record, which I see is distinguishable from them preparing the privilege log. The board would then look at the privilege log and assess what could go into the file, and then Mr. Hamilton could appeal that.
Right, and all my questions have been premised on the point that this thing, this file, is either constructively already before the board or would be one that the duty to assist would require the board to get, right?
Mm-hmm.
For me, right? But my series of questions now were really, okay, how if we reject your position that the work product doctrine doesn't protect these materials at all, trying to work through how logistically this would work. Right, because it seems to me, Judge Tote's question, I had understood to say, well, maybe the regional council prepares the equivalent of the privilege log, allowing the veteran to challenge the items and say, no, I get these, and if they can't resolve the issue, then the board resolves it as part of the decision. Is that sort of generically how you're seeing this working, if in fact we have to go that route?
I think that that could work. I think we're not quite there yet, and the agency certainly is best positioned to decide how to craft that procedure, but we would be satisfied with something so long as there's an avenue to judicial review of whatever is determined to be in the record or not.
What would you think of the potential solution of simply having the board member do an in-camera review of such files, and then through the lens of the proclaimant system?
If there's a detailed decision explaining as to each document, just to pick up on Your Honor's point that this is really a document-by-document analysis, if there's a sufficiently detailed decision that Mr. Hamilton can evaluate whether to appeal, I think that could work.
So the second half of my question is, let's say the attorney work product does not apply. The whole file's discoverable at all. What do we then make of the VA attorney's notes who earlier settled the case? Like, is that probative? Is that, because I imagine nobody wants to litigate whether those are preclusive, what the probative value of a lawyer's thought as to whether negligence occurred. Do we ignore it? I mean, what do we make of that?
Answer Judge Toth's questions. Obviously, I'm going to add some more time. We'll add 5 minutes, and we'll see where we go. This is important.
Thank you. A couple responses to that question, Your Honor. I think we're really mainly concerned with the evidentiary development that happened here, and that is subject to a different scrutiny than attorney opinion work product, obviously. And we're mainly concerned with the factual basis of the settlement and any evidence that would accordingly be relevant to the 1151 claims. I think it's obviously a more prickly situation when we talk about notes. I will say that if any of those notes formed the basis of and were incorporated into the reasoning for offering the settlement, then we really have reasoning for a final agency action there. And I think the Supreme Court case NLRB v. Sears supports that if any notes were made saying here's why we're settling, and the settlement is offered, and those notes are really inextricably intertwined with the actual offer of the settlement, at that point, the possibility of future litigation is terminated. There's a settlement. By accepting it, Mr. Hamilton gives up.
That just speaks to whether the exemption applies in that case. So you're right, that whether they would be covered by work product. Here, I mean, my hypothetical is basically, let's just say there's no work product, everybody gets it, everybody gets to see it, everybody gets to use it. I imagine you'd have a situation like, it would be like Judge Allen in a case called Healy, where it's about the M21, and it's basically, the board's not required to follow the M21, but they sure as heck have to explain, you know, why they aren't. I imagine some similar dynamics might apply in this case, where the board, I mean, it's not binding, there's no collateral estoppel, they're not precluded from making a contrary finding, but I'm certain they'd have to account for why this, again, if this is evidentiary, if this is something we can look at, why there's this countervailing opinion there.
Absolutely, Your Honor, and I'll acknowledge that the standards for offering a settlement and granting the 1151 claims are different here, but we would certainly be happy with a rule where the board at least has to acknowledge the reasoning for similar.
Well, no, I mean, I don't want to make a rule. I just imagine litigating cases where, you know, the board makes its finding and then the person says, well, that's not a plausible basis because, you see, here's this attorney from the same agency 10 years earlier looking at the fact and they say all this other stuff. Well, what do we make of that? I mean, is it evidence? Is it covered by evidentiary rules? Is it, like, how do we assess the probative value of the finding in light of this? Again, this is why they want to protect it. It makes sense.
Mm-hmm. I mean, as Your Honor's question suggested, I think it would fall into a category similar to relevant agency guidance. It's not binding. Certainly, it doesn't stop the agency from acting one way or another on the 1151 claims, but it is relevant reasoning. It would be, I guess, the guidance manual is the best analogy there. You know, in benefits cases, we have the director of compensation service issuing opinions on things which the board is not bound by, and the board is always reviewing the matter de novo. But if there's a favorable determination that led to the settlement and that determination is somehow relevant to the merit of the 1151 claim, then it should be discussed.
But we don't have to, if we ruled in your favor, even accepting that the work product doctrine applies, right, generically, these are all questions that then have to be answered down the road because nobody knows what's in this file, right?
There's an awful lot that's downstream here, Your Honor, because of how little we know.
Judge Greenberg, do you have any questions?
Yes, I do. Counsel, what is the precise order you'd like the court to enter?
We'd like the court to enter an order that the work product doctrine does not apply to determine the scope of the record in Mr. Hamilton's 1151 claims and remand for the board to consider those claims based on the entire record.
Thank you.
And if the court... If the court sees a need to get into some more details for guidance to the board in the future, we would ask it to prescribe that the evidence that the secretary listed in his brief is not something that could be excluded for some other reason from the record. And I will reserve the remainder of my time.
We'll give you your full.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Hamill. And you should know that you can have extra time as well. So,
may it please the court. The protection of attorney work product is essential to the practice of law. That's the words of the Supreme Court. Not optional or suggested, essential. If attorney work product is not protected, it will chill the practice of law. And it will impair the ability of attorneys to provide effective assistance to their clients. What is now put down in writing...
Let me ask you, what's the harm, right? Because, it's one thing to be a private practitioner representing a corporation, and a settlement could settle between two parties, but there might be other parties who could sort of leverage up on that settlement, and they want to protect that. Here, I mean, what's the harm to the agency, the FTCA, that's settled, and there's, other than the 1151 claim, there's no risk of future litigation. So what's the harm?
Your Honor, the harm is what happens in other cases. The harm is how the attorneys for the secretary can prepare in future cases. So like the Supreme Court said in Hickman, it chills the practice of law. What is now put down in writing, attorney notes, thoughts, interviews, will not be put down. Furthermore, when it comes to tort claims and the VA, the VA attorneys practice preventative law. So they're not just interested in this particular case, should we do a settlement or not for this particular veteran. They're interested in pursuing preventative law, to look to see if there's some sort of procedures going on that have a bigger impact within the VA and what can be done to improve those practices within the VA and help other veterans. So it's not so narrow as we're just looking at one veteran, we just care about this veteran and what happened to this veteran. It's a lot wider what the attorneys do in order to investigate tort claims.
So is your I just want to make sure I get the Secretary's position. As I understand it, the Secretary's position about the work product doctrine is that it applies in the same way here, meaning in the 1151 context, right? It applies in the same way as it would if you were somewhere else. In other words, the file that we have here, the administrative file, whatever we want to call it, is, according to the Secretary, subject to work product protection, right, as just like other things prepared in anticipation of litigation. And you're not suggesting that it gets more protection in this context than it would outside.
That's correct, Your Honor. And this is outside. When tort claims are not settled, they go to federal district courts throughout the nation. So wherever the tort took place, that is where the suit is being defended by the Secretary.
No. What I just wanted to make sure is, as I understood your briefing, and it seems like this is the answer, right, this is a predicate to my next question, which is you're saying there is this well-established body of law about work product, generically, that applies to the administrative file created as part of the six-month period under the FTCA. And it applies to protect that material, if it's protectable under the doctrine, in an 1151 context before the board, in a state law litigation on something else, in a federal district court litigation. In other words, you're not saying that it somehow gets more protection because it's in the 1151 context than it would somewhere else.
Correct, Your Honor. But if I can follow up a little bit more on my answer to Judge Toth, when it comes to the harm, the harm is not here. The harm is not in the 1151 claims. The harm is to the practice of law when VA is defending tort claims. And those go to federal court. So we're talking about impairing the ability of VA to defend tort claims and also discover information that might help other veterans, maybe system-wide. But it goes to the practice of law in federal district courts. So that's the impact. It's not here. What we're talking about is impacting the ability of VA to defend tort actions in federal court.
But I understand that argument. That didn't come through strongly in briefing, but it's one that we have talked about internally in chambers, right? But now that we've established, in response to my other point, that the doctrine on the Secretary's view applies the same way here to protect the material as it would if you were in the District of Minnesota or wherever. Okay. Don't we have to remand? Because what happened here is, assume with me that this material was before the board or that the duty to assist would have required the board to get it, okay? Nobody did the kind of things you do in a district court to assess a work product assertion, right? Nobody ever looked at this file, right? It would be as if a district judge just said, I'm not going to do an in-camera review. I'm not going to look. And so if the doctrine applies in no greater way when something is pending before the board as it would somewhere else, then it seems to me I don't see how we can affirm because nobody has ever looked at this document or this file.
Your Honor, the file in this case, and there was a question to be prepared to answer, what is in a claim file? I think that might be helpful to just go through that.
Well, no, now you're going to, and yes, please do because we asked you, but you're not going to, though, offer us, this is, I've looked at Mr. Hamilton's file and here's what in it. Right?
No, I'm not. Your Honor.
You can't do that, right? So I will be interested to hear what you're going to say. I just want to preface it by saying, I still, even if you say to me, these are 10 things that we usually have in a file, right? Nobody has any idea what is in this file. You agree with me, right? I mean, at least the before the board, nobody has any idea what is in this file.
That's partly why I want to cover this, because some of the stuff, we do have an idea. Some of the stuff appellant received. So let me just cover this. I think it will help with the discussion. So first, I'm going to divide this into two categories. First, there's work product, attorney work product. So there typically would be a tort report by the attorney evaluating the strength and weaknesses of the tort claim.
Now, and I want you to keep going, but I want to just make the point. We don't know if such a report exists in Mr. Hamilton's file, do we?
We don't, Your Honor.
doesn't that say that if the work product doctrine applies, but we don't know, I could ask you this for each thing you're going to do, and I'm not going to do it, because the answer to every single one of them is nobody has ever looked to see what is in here. And so the mere fact that we might know what generically is in there, right? So, for example, this memo, right, that the tort evaluation, right? The work product doctrine wouldn't protect factual statements in that, right?
I would disagree, Your Honor. To the extent that the factual statements represent the thought process of the attorneys, it would.
Absolutely. And again, right, how do we know, right? Because if the statement was in this memo, hypothetically, there are 10 people who witnessed the incident, and they just list the 10, okay? Versus, there are 10 people who witnessed the incident, the most important of which are the following five. There is a major distinction between those two things, because arguably the list of 10 people who witnessed the is no attorney work thought, as opposed to the second one, which shows some attorney thought that says, hey, five of these are better than the other five, right?
Right, Your Honor. Yeah.
So if the board, my point is, if the work product doctrine applies and nobody has ever looked at the file, how could we possibly say then no harm, no foul?
Your Honor, in courts across the country, all different kinds of courts, the work product privilege applies. And attorneys take notes, they reach out and they get information from witnesses, and they maybe take notes of witness statements. None of that gets disclosed. That is attorney work product. That is how it functions in this country. So you're saying no one's seen it, that's how it always works, Your Honor?
No, it's not. I know I rode the dinosaur to work when I was a practicing lawyer, but for 10 years I worked and I did a lot of discovery and for big companies. And what would happen is we would get discovery requests. And if we thought things were protected by the work product doctrine, it wasn't that we were silent about it. We had to do a privilege log. We had to say, there's this, 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 and then we would give it to the other side. And the other side, if they thought, well, that's crazy, right? What they would do is say to the judge, this isn't protected by the work product doctrine. And the judge would, under most circumstances, a magistrate judge would look at the document and say it's protected or it's not, right? Nobody ever did any of this here, none of it. And so that's why I just don't see how, even if we assume that the work product doctrine applies, if it applies in the same way and not more, with nobody ever looking at it, because nobody knows what's in it. There's no privilege log. So there's no – I just don't see how we could say – we'd be saying it gets more protection here than it does anywhere else.
Let me put it this way, Your Honor, because my background is criminal law. In criminal law, we don't use a privilege log. We simply turn over discovery, and maybe there's Brady material that has to be turned over. But the attorney's thought processes are not turned over. They're not revealed in a privilege log.
And so, attorney – listen – if the work product doctrine applies in the same way, which we're assuming now it does, right, then I'm with you on what's called opinion work product, right? So if we take Rule 26b-3 as an example, well, as the prototypical in most federal courts, right, opinion work product is actually treated just like a privilege, an actual privilege, meaning you can't pierce it, no matter how great the need. The other side can never get it, right?
Right.
But for non-opinion work product, it isn't like a privilege, right? There can be showings that either it's not protected, or even if it is protected by the doctrine, that there's substantial need given what we've got here. The basic thing is I just don't see how we can say that the board was right here if the board never did anything to assess whether or not the work product doctrine actually protected what's in this file.
I think the answer to that, Your Honor, is the context. And I'm going to finish going through my list here. So number one is the tort report completed by the attorney. could be there or is typically there, a medical advisory opinion. And the medical advisory opinion is not the typical medical opinion that you'd see in either compensation cases or 1151. So it's not designed to answer a broad question about whether something is more likely than not. It's really an opinion that is sought to answer specific legal questions about the facts of the case.
How do we know that? How do we know that?
I think you know it because, well, for one thing, I could submit a declaration to this court to back that up.
No, but my point is, right, an expert, Judge Toth, I think, wrote an opinion for our court that said that in our context, right, a CMP examiner is nothing more than an expert witness. I can't imagine that in the federal tort claims context in the administrative process that the expert evidence from a doctor is treated any differently than an expert evidence is treated everywhere else. It doesn't answer legal questions. It can inform legal questions, right? You know, did this violate the standard of care in Minneapolis, St. Paul for, right, because it's locality driven in the FTCA?
Correct, Your Honor.
So, and we have absolutely no idea if there is such an opinion in Mr. Hamilton's file, what it says, or whether it would be protectable, right?
Right. But, Your Honor, the important thing is context. What we're doing in the tort claims context is developing a case to see whether there should be a settlement or we should proceed to trial. This is not the same thing as a compensation claim where we're looking to see whether a standard has been met and we get a medical opinion that has to address all the evidence and is not, like, one-sided. Here we're talking, because of the context, it's one-sided. It's for the VA. It's to answer questions that VA has.
What do you mean it's one-sided? I mean, are you saying that what the regional counsel says to the doctor is, I want you to give me this opinion, but you must say that it did not violate the standard of care?
No, you're
wrong. I mean, wouldn't it be like, hey, what is the relevant standard of care for this in this locality? And given the facts of this case, what is your expert opinion about whether it was violated? Listen, when I was practicing law, got lots of expert opinions that were really detrimental to my clients. And you know what? They didn't see the light of day because we didn't hire the expert, right? If the expert said, hey, this is no good, and we'd say, well, thank you for your time, and that was it, right? I mean, it wasn't like, you know, I don't understand this one-sided concept.
Your Honor, the VA contracts with the experts for these medical advisory opinions, and part of this is that the examiner who provides the opinion, part of the contract is that it's not discoverable, that they will not be forced to provide a deposition in the case. So it's within the understanding that this is for a party to a potential lawsuit. They're getting the legal opinion for that. This is very different from what happens in a compensation claim where all the evidence has to get considered and we have to check all the boxes to make sure everything was done properly. Here it's just to satisfy an attorney.
So your understanding is that the VA makes promises to people that it hires as an expert witness that they will never be deposed?
That they will not be forced to depose. It's in the contract.
What does it mean, forced to depose? If I'm a United States magistrate judge and I decide that this report is something that is from somebody who is discoverable, and I issue an order that requires the person to sit, the person's going to sit for a deposition, right?
Right, Your Honor.
So, and by the way, in this case, do we know if there is such a medical opinion in the file?
I don't want to reveal that, Your Honor. I don't want to be accused of
Right. Listen, this is a truly bizarre situation, right? Because likely you and Mr. Seiler are the only people in the courtroom who know what's in the file. But we know that the Federal Circuit tells us that we can't consider that because that would be equivalent of getting an affidavit about mailing, like in kind, right? So we can't. And the board didn't look at it at all. But the VA's position is, but we're all just going to assume that there's nothing in this file that could possibly not be protected by work product, and that even if it was, there would be substantial need to have it.
Well, Your Honor, my point is
we can't look at this the same way we look at a regular opinion. It's in a different context. And I think all of this, so the other two things I would add to the list of work product is witness statements and interview notes. And so those would be protected under the work product because, as attorney work product, because they would reveal the attorney's thoughts and depending upon the questions that are asked.
How do we know that, though? Right? I mean, I used to always tell young associates at the beginning of notes that you take, write down, these notes include my opinions about legal matters, right? And I said, you know, the worst thing you can do is try to be a stenographer and take down verbatim what is said, because then you're adding nothing to it. But we don't know.
There is a way of knowing, Your Honor.
In this case? There is.
In this case. In every case. So in every case, a veteran could file either a FOIA or a Privacy Act request for the tort claim file. And if that's denied, there are appellate rights, which includes in-camera review. You know, the FOIA statute as a provision includes provisions for in-camera review of the document. So it can be reviewed.
So in the context of the non-adversarial benefits process, the only way that a veteran can get the type of review of materials to ensure that they actually are protected by the work product doctrine is to go outside of the benefit system and file a lawsuit in federal district court under FOIA or the Privacy Act?
I'm not saying it's the only way, but that
but
is
what's the other way?
Okay, another way, Your Honor, would be in this case, if appellant had said in the RBA dispute process that we're not happy with the contents of the RBA, we think that the settlement document should be included. We would have put that in there. The settlement document is not attorney work product.
Yeah, but the file, right? What's in the file, right? It wouldn't have mattered in the are you saying that under the Rule 10 process that somehow they've waived this argument?
No, I'm not making that argument. You're asking me for other means of getting what's in the tort claim file.
So
that is a way. They could ask for it. They could simply ask for it in the Rule 10 process. And they could get non-attorney work product that's included in the tort claim file.
So, I mean, it's your point that with the 1151 claim that someone should initiate parallel proceedings in a federal district court for the discovery for the same claim? Right, I mean, they could file under FOIA, and I dissented in a case called Lawrence, sort of about this issue. The idea would be they'd have to go to federal court to get to kind of adjudicate the discovery for basically the veteran's case.
As far as I think the question was directed at, how do we know what's work product and what's not, or why should we take the VA's word on what is work product? Shouldn't someone look at it? Well, you can look at it by doing a FOIA request. Like that's an option.
Right, but FOIA, I mean, he could get it irrespective of an 1151 claim under FOIA, right? I mean, because here's a question, which is there's FOIA, and they've got exemptions, so they incorporate some of the work product.
They exempt the work product, Your Honor.
Yeah, right. And then you got Rule 26, they've got Hickman, so you got case law, a federal rule, and a federal statute that all have – And, you know, with certain exceptions with the FOIA, I mean, they're more or less overlap. Is what you're asking here broader than those protections?
No.
Is it simply we can read Rule 26, we can read FOIA, and then whatever protections are in there for materials, that's what the Secretary is asking. Or, I guess it seems to me you're asking something a little bit broader than that, which is basically that none of this is discoverable.
No, not at all, Your Honor. As far as attorney work product, it's not. And that there may also be other things in the claim file that aren't discoverable, such as personnel records. Medical records are not actually in the claim file, and we did not represent that they are. So for medical record review for the attorneys working on tort claims, they have a viewer, an online viewer, where they're able to look at VA treatment records. And when they get a medical advisory opinion, they give the medical expert access to those records. So in the tort claim... So
what I'm asking about broader, I mean, for instance, like a basic practice under Rule 26 is, you know, you're a defendant in a lawsuit, and there's initial disclosures. So even before any interrogatory, any discovery request, you just, like, here are the things that Rule 26 requires us to disclose, right? It's a document, anything relevant. And it's nobody here even did that. So, it seems to suggest that that's not even, we didn't even have to take a look at it. There are no, the position seems to me it's just not subject to discovery in total.
Your Honor, in a typical case for a tort claim, it really doesn't involve the same considerations as 1151. It's really not that relevant. We're asking a different question, and we're asking it in a different context. We're asking it in terms of if this were to go to trial.
I appreciate that, but it would be a more plausible if somebody said, "Listen, I've looked at the file. We've turned over the aspects of it that we believe are, not attorney work product. The remainder we're going to claim the privilege for." That's a more plausible case than just saying, there's a file that nobody's looked at, and it's out there somewhere, and we believe it's covered for, the four corners that are covered by the work product doctrine.
I think I know where you're going, Ron. So to the extent that my argument has kind of been broad, the argument in the initial brief was really broad. It was for the whole tort claim file. And certainly there are materials in there that would be considered work product. But I would agree that there are documents in there that are not attorney work product. And I can go through them real quick. I know I'm getting slowed down in my list here. So there's a tort claim. It's a standard Form 95 with any attachments that are submitted. Correspondence. So it's correspondence between VA and the claimant. There's paperwork to authorize payment. There are employment verification documents. They're standard Form 50s that the federal government uses. So for any of the providers who provided care in the case, the attorneys working the tort claim will just obtain personnel records to see how long they've been working, what position they're in, that sort of thing. Peer reviews could also be included. Those would be protected under 38 U.S.C. 5705 as quality assurance records. The settlement offer.
Although, as to that point, right, the court was never able to resolve that case. Right, about how the duty to assist and the peer reports come together, right? Because it turned out, I'm blanking on the case, but I was a law professor and it was argued at Stetson, and right at the end of the argument it became clear that, in fact, there was no report in the case. So assume with me that under Azubio, this file met the requirements for constructive possession of relevance and reasonableness. Okay, so it was before the board. Wouldn't the board have had to do just something because FOIA talks about going to the federal district court when you have made a request, right? Here, because the board has a duty, right, the duty to assist, not just to get the records, but, as Azubio talks about, the constructive possession is wound up in the duty to assist. But in any event, if the document is constructively before the board, this file, isn't at a minimum the board discussion insufficient because it doesn't say what you're saying?
With your assumptions, yes, Your Honor. Yes, I would agree with that. But it's not reasonable to assume that this would not be in the constructive possession because it's attorney work product. And I think what it comes down to is...
Well, but that's circular, right? We don't know, because I think you're conceding that not everything in this file is attorney work product.
Right. I just read some items. Yeah.
Right. That's what I mean. Right. And so we know that the file itself contains lots of different things, some of which might be protected by the attorney work product. Some of them might actually be opinion work product, right, which is totally protected.
Right.
And others aren't. As under my hypothetical, it's before the board, right? The board's discussion, it seems to me, is inadequate because it doesn't do what you're doing, which is say, well, there are parts of this that, yes, they're not protected, but it doesn't matter that the appellant hasn't seen it because it isn't relevant to the 1151 claim that we have.
Your Honor, it's not typically done when there has been a prior tort claim and then there's an 1151 claim because of the context. They're separate issues. They involve different considerations for... An 1151 claim, like here, there was a medical opinion provided that address the specific standard for an 1151 claim. And here the veteran is kind of reaching out with kind of a vague argument about, I want the tort claim file, without really specifying what they want. It's kind of a fishing expedition for something that may be related but doesn't really pertain to the 1151 claim. The information that pertains to
How would they ask with much greater specificity?
They could ask for all, they could say, here, the VLJ said it was very important to have the settlement documents. Could we please have the settlement documents? They should be in the RBA. And we would have put it in the RBA. In fact, we will be happy to supplement the rope with the settlement documents.
So even on that point, right, this is a curious board decision, right, because the board members seemed to think it was really important at the hearing that they get these documents.
Just to offset, Your Honor. For offset.
I have no idea why the VLJ said that, right? Because she seemed to be suggesting it's very important. But then it appears that this isn't even like going to someplace else in the federal government to get the documents. It's within the VA. And then in the decision, the VLJ just says, well, you didn't give them to me. Well, but they were VA documents. If they thought that, if the VLJ thought it was so important, isn't that an error right there?
It's important only to offset, Your Honor. No, it's not error right there. It was only important as to offset. We know by regulations that we have to offset any tort settlement from any 1151 benefits. So that's why it's important. If it was more important, then it certainly could have been presented and should have really been in the RBA. And we can certainly...
Why isn't it error for the board? I mean, I think it's strange to say that it only mattered to the board member because of offset, given the way in which he discussed it at the hearing, but also the reference to it in the decision. Because if it only matters as to offset, why would the VLJ have mentioned it in the decision? Because they weren't awarding 1151 benefits, so there'd never be an offset.
Your Honor, the Secretary would be happy to supplement the rope, and you can see the importance of the settlement agreement. We'd be happy to put that in we'd do an amended rope if this court wants to show you what's in the settlement agreement. We'd be happy to do that. We think that this case comes down to a single question. When Congress enacted 5103A, requiring VA to assist veterans, did Congress intend to respect attorney work product? Or did Congress intend that the VA would provide all information regardless of attorney work product, which I think is appellant's position here. The authority against that, against providing attorney work product, is Hickman, most clearly.
So let's assume, I'm going to ask you.
You can keep going.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you what I asked opposing counsel. Let's assume attorney work product applies, and then somebody has to differentiate between what within a file is covered and what isn't. Who is that person? We should make the determination. Who would look at a file and figure out what's privileged?
I think initially the attorneys who handle, or the people from VA who handle tort claims, would give whatever information is relevant into the veterans claim file.
And then should they make a privilege log? And then who would adjudicate that?
I guess it's possible that we could come up with a process for privileges.
These are hard questions. I mean, I understand. That's one of the reasons I'm asking. But I say this just because, you know, to not do things like this would effectuate a much broader – this is kind of what I asked before, where VA would be getting much broader protections than either the statute or the rule or case law or anything provides. Somebody has you know, if attorney work product applies, it applies to information within a file. It doesn't just cover entire files. Somebody has to look at that. And who is that person? How do they do it?
Well, Your Honor, like I said before, if the person, the veteran, is always entitled to make a claim, a FOIA or a Privacy Act claim, to obtain documents that were not turned over.
I mean, I asked this before. I mean, what is the practical value to having somebody litigate in federal court over just discovery or us in a veterans benefits claim? Why not handle it within our system?
It could also be brought up to the board.
Okay, so again, who's going to do the screening and then who's going to adjudicate it?
I think maybe something could be worked out by the board, but certainly if this veteran had gone to the board and said, hey, I'm missing things from my tort claim file, I think those would help me, then the board could have addressed it. But
I mean, so 3.159C says basically where a person reasonably identifies a record that's in the possession of the federal government, the board has a duty to go find it, right? I mean, here, I mean, the person mentioned the settlement. They mentioned the case. I mean, is 3.159C implicated?
Not to attorney work product. No, Your Honor. Congress did not intend this.
Is a conclusion that arrives after somebody's actually looked at something. I mean, it's premised on like an attempt to get something, look at it, and turn it over, and then we just sort of protect certain materials of that. It's not an exemption to 3.159C. It's like, oh, you know, we don't have any duty to go look for it because we're just going to. If it's attorney work product, also, I mean, is that the board makes that determination and they without ever looking at it?
Your Honor, there's no reason to go there. There is all kinds of attorney work product. Like, there's attorney work product in this case prepared by my office, prepared by myself.
I did attorney work product all the time. I would write on the top of the pages, attorney work product, you know. So I understand somebody eventually, if what an attorney produces is subject to a discovery request, I mean, somebody has to actually look at it and then deem it work product.
Your Honor, for all the claims that get remanded, it probably could be something that a veteran could say, hey, I want this attorney's work product. Even for cases that go up to the federal circuit, you could say, I want DOJ's work product. I think there could be something in there to help me. This is not what the attorney work product should be protected. And it shouldn't be like a fishing expedition for a veteran who thinks, I've got information, I've got an opinion on my claim, but I want to fish.
Part of the difficulty we have is there's really no discovery rules. Like, we don't have clear discovery rules within the veterans benefit system. So we have a statutory system that applies technically that you have to go to federal court to enforce. But those are the statutory requirements. And then you've got the federal rules, which, again, we're kind of using by analogy here. Give me some type of rule where someone would make a determination or some regular process.
Your Honor, the easiest answer is the board. If there's some kind of complaint raised to the board can address it. If the board doesn't address it in a satisfactory way, this court can say that and send it back down.
I mean, again, does the board have to look at it? Like, so the board under 3.159C, a person identifies a document, so listen, the FTCA claim, here's the date, here's the basic info on it. Okay, Roger. I'll get the file. I'll take a look at it. I'll see there's a memo here that's clearly off limits. There's the opinion. I mean, they could, so there's certain things off limits, but that's actually, I mean, that's a discovery process you're describing. What the argument I hear sometimes is just, oh, well, it's a claims file and there's going to be work product in there. So it's just beyond reach altogether.
Your Honor, I would suggest that the process that we have works adequately, especially if appellant avails themselves of the RBA disputes. They can raise it before the board and say, I didn't get this. And when it comes up here, they can say, this was constructively before the board. We want it here. Those give a typical veteran a good opportunity to get everything in the claim file that they need
but
for it to be adjudicated.
And I know you're over time to just – so, but – whether we look at this through the lens of the duty to assist under 3.159 and saying that the board would have an obligation to go get this or explain why it didn't, or we look at this through the lens of a Zubio and that it already was there, created by VA and there, what more would a veteran need to do to tee that up other than what was done here?
Oh, well, what was done here, they could have asked for the settlement documents. They could have either asked the board for the settlement documents or they could have asked for it in the RBA dispute time and said this was constructively before the board. We'd like it, and they would have it, and we wouldn't be disputing the settlement documents.
You're just talking about the settlement document, right? We're talking about the broader context of the file.
I think you've got to be clearer, Your Honor. You can't just say I want everything in the file when you know there's attorney work product in there. And to the extent that they're saying the attorney work product doesn't apply, it certainly does. These documents were prepared in anticipation of litigation. And it would be contrary to the Federal Rule of Civil Procedure. It would be going around it to say VA has to turn over this information when the federal rules say you don't turn it over. And this case, the impact of this case, is in federal court because that's where federal tort claims are litigated. So it's really undermining the federal rules of civil procedure.
I appreciate your argument that there might be cases that could involve potentially multiple claimants where, you know, the standard, like an admission as to a breach of the standard of care could expose you to future litigation involving, like, other parties. So I appreciate that argument. But here, I mean, it's one person. It's their claim. That claim's settled. There's no future your litigation beyond an 1151 claim. I mean, is that something – again, that was kind of my first question about the harm.
That's Hickman, Your Honor. If you turn it over in this case, attorneys are not dumb. They're going to know what happens. They're going to know that there's a potential when they talk to witnesses, when they write down their notes, that that could be disclosed. It's going to change how they practice law. So that's why Hickman says it's essential. It's been the rule for 75 years. It's essential that attorney work product be protected. Otherwise, it chills the practice of law. Things that are written down won't get written down. And for VA purposes here, things that they look into about maybe system-wide problems within VA won't get asked about, or the people who are answering those questions will stop answering the questions because they'll know that whatever they say may get out. So it helps the attorneys practice law in a way that's effective. And it would undermine that if this court says the attorney work product privilege doesn't apply. Now, to the extent that the documents are not attorney work products, I would say in this case, it really wasn't developed in the briefing exactly what they want. And you can say they don't know what was in there, so how can they ask what they want? To the extent they're asking for attorney work product, they're not entitled to it. Under Hickman, under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, the FOIA and Privacy Act recognize the importance of attorney work product. Even 5103A just says reasonable efforts to assist the client.
And Mr. Hamill, I want to make sure that Judge Toth and Judge Greenberg get to ask you any questions. As an old civil procedure teacher, I could talk about the work product doctrine all day, as some of my students will tell you. But Judge Toth, do you have anything? Judge Greenberg?
Yes. What statute, counsel, what specific statute provides that any work product is protected when it's produced or manifest by the government in the context of a favored class of litigant, that is veterans? Why should the work product point to the statute that says work product need not be turned over to the veteran?
Your Honor, the federal rules has a rule.
I'm asking for a statute. Is there a statute? Yeah. This is a favored class of litigant. We all agree on that. This is a class of litigant that Congress, by statute, says has the benefit of the administrative decider, perfecter of the file, to perfect it. Go find the evidence or go find the facts that favor the veteran. So consistent with that, wouldn't Congress have expressly said, except for work product or some other exceptions? What statute gives work product protection to the government in the context of a veteran's claim?
There is no statute, but the principles of Hickman say that it's essential to the practice of law. And
Hold it. When was Hickman v. Taylor decided?
1947, Your Honor.
Right, and there was no judicial review of veterans' cases until 1988. Does that matter?
It matters. It doesn't change the analysis, Your Honor. Even in courts that act protectively towards a class of people, like juvenile law or even veterans' law, where they take a paternalistic approach to a group of people, attorney work product is protected. So this concept applies throughout the law. Maybe there is a privilege log that's required in some cases, but this is a principle that was established 75 years ago that it applies throughout the country, even in cases where, like, we're trying to protect juveniles. So it works against juveniles. It works against people who are, you know, on trial for their life or, you know, to remain free in criminal cases. So this is not a principle. The work product is something that you could take it or leave it. The U.S. Supreme Court says is essential.
Thank you. That's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Hamer.
Okay. Can I just briefly conclude? The only conclusion that can be drawn here is that Congress did not intend to require VA to turn over attorney work product documents where VA provides documents to assist the veterans when they provide veterans with their claims under 5103A. Therefore, this court should affirm the board's decision. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for answering all our questions. Ms. Donahower?
I just want to address opposing counsel's concerns about the chilling effect in future litigation. The case law says that courts won't imply a waiver of this protection when the prior disclosure was pursuant to a court order. So I think that sufficiently addresses the fears about downstream consequences.
I'm not sure it does, because I had understood Mr. Hamel to be making that argument in this context, which is it's easy to say with respect to Mr. Hamilton that any interest the government had in protecting work product is done because the file's closed. As Judge Toth referenced, there aren't like other joint people out there who were claimants, right? So you could easily say in that context, well, there's no work product protection. But I had understood Mr. Hamel's point to be, but you can't just look at one case, right? You have to think about the fact that the government and its lawyers who do get to represent the government as if they were individual tortfeasors under the FTCA, that they would be chilled in the development of their cases generically if they knew that sometimes their stuff would be protected and other times it wouldn't.
And that's actually what I'm addressing, Your Honor. I think in the case that doesn't settle and potentially goes to litigation, a court can say that the disclosure through the VA process was not a waiver for purposes of the civil litigation before us.
But again, that gets back to the point, you know, as I used to say, right, is that when I was practicing, is that you never knew which case was going to get to trial until you got to trial. And you're right. And so then you have to treat every case when it comes in the door as if it's going to be tried. Because what you learn over time is you're shocked by the cases that actually end up going to trial as opposed to the ones that don't. So you sort of have to treat them at the beginning, right? Here, in terms of the protection, right, if you say, oh, don't worry, your stuff will be protected if you go to court, the whole idea is if I don't know that as I'm going through the process, that skews what I'm going to do.
I think this case really just comes down to the agency's left hand knowing what the right hand is doing. And so we can get into debates about the chilling effect, but this within the facts of this case, two non-adversarial processes on one veteran's claims that are substantively similar, the agency needs to know the relevant evidence it developed in one of those processes when it looks at the other claims. And I don't think the work product doctrine has any say in that matter.
So, so the way you started that sentence was a narrower way, right? In other words, it seemed to me to be saying the agency should look and see what is protected and what isn't, right? But it seems to me you're also making a much broader argument, swinging well beyond the fences, to say that there simply is no protection at all. Because if there's no protection, then you should be able to get it all. It's not a question of somebody looking at it. It's a question of they should have gotten it for you. Are you really pressing that
point?
I think the court can resolve this case in Mr. Hamilton's favor without going there. I think certainly this is really about transparency within in the system, and the worst that could happen here is that the truth about how Mr. Hamilton's claim was handled would come out. But there are certainly avenues that could be pursued and that VA has made no attempt to pursue here to make sure that at least the relevant evidence that was developed here made it before the board in Mr. Hamilton's case. And there's a lot of seeming misunderstanding about how this doctrine applies. It's for the party invoking the protection to be specific about what it applies to and why. And that only says that it's eligible for the protection. And there are countervailing policies that exist in the veteran sphere that could override that protection regardless. And I think on a related note, it's curious that in this proclaimant system, it's okay to look at the tort claim file for purposes of offsetting Mr. Hamilton's benefits, but at the same time, opposing counsel's arguing it's not okay to look at the relevant evidence that was developed for the purpose of assessing the merit of his 1151 claims. It can't be that we look at that file for the purpose of the offset, but not when it benefit Mr. Hamilton. If there are no further questions, we'd ask for an order that VA at least look at everything that was in the file here, and if the court deems it necessary, to provide some guidance to the board about how to assess what is and should be in Mr. Hamilton's file before the board.
Let me just see if my colleagues have any questions. Judge Greenberg?
No, I'm fine. Thank you.
Judge Toth? Thank you very much. We want to thank the parties for their arguments today and the briefing and the supplemental briefing. As you've been able to tell, it's an issue that has captivated the court. And so we appreciate the arguments this morning. And so with that, the case is submitted, and we'll come down and greet counsel.